If you're using the paper outline, it should be on page 2 of Roman numeral 3, the thing which shall come to pass hereafter. This comprises most of the book, chapter 6 to chapter 18. Now, chapters 6 through 9 deal with the events of the first half. Chapters 10 through 14 will deal with the events of the middle. And then 15 through 18, with one exception, will deal with the events of the second half. So chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9 deal with the events of the first half. And the chart you should be looking at in your charts collection should be that'll be page 4. And the first half of the tribulation comprises two of the three series of judgments, the seven seal judgments of the first quarter and the seven trumpet judgments of the second quarter. So to give you the overall structure, the first half is chapter 6, 7, 8, and 9, plus chapter 17, which follows the low recurrence. The middle covers chapters 10 through 14. The second half covers chapters 15, 16, and 18. The series of judgments provide the chronological sequence. So you have the seal judgments of chapter 6. They'll cover the first quarter of the tribulation, then the trumpet judgments, chapters 8 and 9, the second quarter of the tribulation. Now, there are other events which happen throughout the first half of the tribulation. So seals and trumpets are chronological. One follows the other. But while the seal judgments and while the trumpet judgments are being put out, there are things happening throughout the first half. Number one, you have Elijah the prophet returning to work with Israel to get them ready for the national salvation. This is not Revelation. This is Malachi chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. Malachi 4, verse 5 and 6. The government of the first half of the tribulation is that of 10 kingdoms with 10 kings. That's the government. The government of the first half, there'll be a restructuring of the world's borders. There'll only be 10 nations plus Israel. And 10 men will rule the world co-equally. That's primarily Daniel chapter 7, but we'll see some of this in Revelation chapter 17. You have also the ministry of the 144,000 Jews, that's probably what we'll get to starting tomorrow afternoon. You also have the testimony of the two witnesses, we'll see that in chapter 11. And you have the rule of ecclesiastical or religious Babylon in chapter 17. These are events happening throughout the first half while the seal judgments and trumpet judgments get poured out. So we deal with the seal judgments. And the first seal judgment, you have the conquest of the Antichrist. The first horseman represents the Antichrist, will be the key earthly figure in this period of time. He's wearing a Stephanos crown, which is the crown of an overcomer, a crown of a victor. Doesn't emphasize sovereignty or royalty, emphasizes overcomer and victor. We shall see developing in the tribulation is a counterfeit trinity. The true trinity involves God the Father, who gave his authority to the true Son. And Satan will play the role of the counterfeit father, and he will give his authority over to the counterfeit son, the Antichrist. You will have God the Holy Spirit, and the goal of the Spirit is to draw people to worship the true Son. The false prophet will be the counterfeit spirit who will draw all men to worship the counterfeit Son. And finally, you have the God the Son, the true God the Son, Jesus the Messiah, and the counterfeit Son will be the Antichrist. Just as the true Son has a multiplicity of names and titles, and each name or title says something about his person, something about his work, the same thing is true with the names of the Antichrist. So among his names is in the Old Testament is the seed of Satan in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. The little horn in Daniel chapter 7, verse 8. The king of fierce countenance in Daniel chapter 8, verse 23. The prince that shall come in Daniel chapter 9, verse 26. The desolator in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. And the willful king in Daniel 11, verse 36. So six of these names are all in the Hebrew Bible. Only one in Genesis 3:15. All the others come from Daniel, which is the corollary book with the book of Revelation. Among the New Testament names of the Antichrist, he's called the man of sin and the son of perdition, both in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. He's also called the lawless one in 2 Thess 2, verse 8. The most common name among us is the Antichrist, but that is not the most common name in the scriptures. But he's called the Antichrist in 1 John 2, verse 22, 1 John 2, 22. The most common name is the beast. One example would be Revelation 11, verse 7, Revelation 11, verse 7. So of these five names, notice three are by Paul in only one chapter of his writings, 2 Thess chapter 2. Other two are by the Apostle John, one in his first epistle and one in Revelation. Let's talk about the origin of the Antichrist, because just as the true Son has a natural and supernatural origin, by the same token, the counterfeit Son will have both a natural and supernatural origin. Now, concerning his natural origin, people often claim that he has to be a Jew. They don't have a verse for it, they just use a logical argument. Jews will only accept a Jewish Messiah. As it turns out, in some parts of Jewish history, they've sometimes accepted a Gentile Messiah like Napoleon. But the bottom line is the Bible never says they accept him as the Messiah. They will enter a covenantal arrangement, but they have often done this, more recently in our time with King Hussein of Jordan, also Egypt. We never accept as the Messiah. Another reason people give is for his being a Jewish one is because the tribe of Dan is missing in Revelation 7. That's true. Dan is missing in Revelation chapter 7. How does that prove he has to be of the tribe of Dan? We'll get to Revelation 7 tomorrow. But he never says he's come to the tribe of Dan, and so John left out Dan from his count of 144,000. And furthermore, Dan does not disappear. Dan will be in the Messianic kingdom according to Ezekiel chapters 47 and 48. 47 and 48. The only biblical evidence they provide is based upon a mistranslation found in the King James Version, where it reads in 11:37, "He shall not regard the God," capital G-O-D, "of his fathers." But that's a bad rendering. Right? If you look at any other translation, As the King James is translated correctly, he will not regard the gods, like mine ASV here, that I'm using. He should not regard the gods of his fathers, and the use of the plural shows a reference to pagan deities. Says the natural origin, he'll be a Gentile, and his Gentileness is seen first of all through typology, because the one typological symbol of the Antichrist is Antiochus Epiphanes, who's spoken of in Daniel 8 and Daniel 11, and he's a Gentile. Also from biblical imagery or symbolism, in Revelation chapter 13, verse 1, and chapter 17, verse 15, he arises out of the sea. And the sea is always a symbol of the Gentile world when used symbolically. And furthermore, he'll be the final ruler of the times of the Gentiles, the last Gentile ruler of the times of the Gentiles, the last Gentile ruler of the fourth Gentile empire, which means he's got to be a Gentile. But Daniel 9, 26 and 27 specifies exactly what kind of Gentile he has to be. He'll be a Gentile of Roman origin. And it'd be good if you just turn to it to follow things easier. What happened to my Bible? Oh, it's hiding? Never hide your Bible. Daniel 9. Now verse 27 says, he shall make a firm covenant with many for 1:7. The pronoun he goes back to its narrowest antecedent, which is the prince that shall come. In other words, the prince that shall come, of verse 26, and the he who makes a covenant is the one and the same individual. Now reading verse 26, after the 70 the anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now notice what it does not say. It does not say the prince that shall come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. What it says is that the people of the prince that shall come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. So what that means is the Antichrist will be of the same ethnic group as those who destroyed the city and the temple. In the year AD 70, it was the Romans that did so. And this means not only will he be a Gentile, he'll be specifically a Gentile of Roman origin. What constituted the Roman origin of that day was four or five different tribal divisions, of which the Italians were just one. The Etruscans was another. And it slips my mind what the other three were at the moment, but about four or five altogether, they made up the Roman ethnic identity. It'll be from that ethnic identity group that he will be a descendant from. And so, as to his natural origin, he will be a Gentile of Roman origin. Now, concerning his supernatural origin, let's turn to Genesis 3. In chapter 3, you have the account of the fall of humanity. So this will also be the chapter that will have the first messianic prophecy. But notice as we read the verse, the first prophecy about the Messiah coming to deal with the issue of sin and Satan, it was not addressed to Adam, nor to Eve. It's addressed specifically to Satan. And it says in verse 16, I will put enmity excuse me, verse 15. I will put enmity between you and woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. When you find the word used twice, like the word seed in this case, used twice, you have to interpret it the same way, unless there's a good reason in the context that says you cannot do it that way. And to understand better what he means by the seed of Satan, let's talk about the seed of Duman. Because when Moses writes, or God through Moses writes, that the Messiah will be of the seed of Duman, this breaks from the natural biblical norm, because you look at all the genealogies of the Hebrew Bible, the two cases of genealogies in the New Testament, they all trace the male line. And the women are either not mentioned at all, or if they are mentioned, they're mentioned in passing, never directly relevant to genealogy. But with the Messiah, it'll be different. He'll be reckoned after the seed of the woman. But Moses doesn't explain why. We don't even know if he knew why. And we would not know why until Isaiah comes along. In Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, Isaiah prophesies, Messiah will be conceived and born of a virgin. Both conceived and born of a virgin. So all of us here had come from two biological sources. So we had a biological mother and a biological father. The Messiah's whole humanity comes from only one biological source, and that is the mother. And therefore, you have no choice but to reckon his seed by means of the seed of Duman. He had no biological father to reckon the seed through. So we learn with Isaiah adding the information, the seed of the woman means a supernatural conception. A supernatural conception. But again, there's two seeds here. The seed of Satan is one of those seeds. It must be understood the same way. A supernatural conception. Now, something like this already took place in Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4. Genesis 6, verses 1 through 4. It talks about the sons of God intermarrying with human women. And the term B'nai Elohim, but the term sons of God in the Hebrew Bible, always refers to angels, good or bad. Now, some people want to make this the one exception, but it's no good reason to make an exception if the text does not demand it. And Genesis 4 is Satan's response to Genesis 3. Because Satan now knows a descendant of the woman he tempted will someday come to defeat him. What he tries to do in chapter 6 is to corrupt the seed of the woman through this intermarriage, producing something that's neither angelic or human, a race of the Nephilim that were destroyed by the flood. What's going to happen in the future, if it hasn't happened yet, will happen in the future is that Satan will impregnate a Gentile woman of Roman origin and produce his seed. So as Paul writes in 2 Thessalonians 2:9, his coming is according to the energizing of Satan. We'll see a repetition of Genesis chapter 6, and here you have another counterfeit element, not just the multiplicity of names, but also the counterfeit God-man concept. As far as his characteristics, Daniel chapter 8, verses 23 to 25 provides these things. One who understands dark sentences. That's the same ability God gave to Daniel to understand dreams and interpretation of riddles. Satan will give the Antichrist the same supernatural power. Secondly, his power is mighty, but not his own power, because he seeks this power from Satan. He will seek to destroy Israel. Fourthly, he'll be characterized by craft and deceit. Fifthly, he'll prosper in his goal. Sixthly, he makes claims of self-deity, claiming to be God. And finally, he'll stand against the prince of princes. He'll militate against anyone worshiping the true God, the true Messiah. A second passage is 11 verses 36 to 39. He'll be characterized by willfulness, self-exaltation, self-deification. He'll claim to be God. He'll speak against the God of gods. He'll be inhumane in his disregard of women. He'll be controlled by Satan. He'll honor a God not honored by his fathers. That would be Satan. He'll conquer by the help of this foreign God. He'll conquer by the help of Satan. Only those who submit to him are going to be elevated. So this is the rider of the first horse. In verse 3 and 4, we have the second horseman. And the second horseman, notice he takes away peace from the earth. He takes away peace from the earth. And the opposite of peace would be war. Within the seven-year tribulation period, there'll be three world wars. And the first world war happens at the beginning of the tribulation. Let's say World War I, I don't mean World War I of the previous First World War. It means the First World War I of the tribulation, the first of three wars in that period of time. Now, Paul, when he writes to the Thessalonians in chapter 5, verses 1 through 3, 5, 1 through 3, he points out, just before the day of the Lord comes, and day of the Lord is the most common biblical term for the tribulation, just before the day of the Lord comes, there'll be a period of peace and false security, and this war will shatter that period of peace and false security. They have the third horseman in verse 5 and 6, who rides a horse carrying a balance. The balance is the symbol of scarcity and famine. And following the first world war of the tribulation, there'll be a worldwide famine of food. But it says the oil and the wine do not hurt. These were used, for example, for medicinal purposes. So you have an abundance. At this point, you have grace mixed with judgment. While there's a shortage of food, there'll be abundance of medicine, oil, and wine for medicinal purposes. The fourth horseman will destroy 25% of the earth's population in this one judgment. Now keep in mind, we're not told how many people die, percentage of people die in most of these judgments, but now and then it gives a percentage. You'll notice there's less and less and less people on the earth. And with this one judgment, 25% of the earth's population will be destroyed. And death in Hades refers to the what happens after death. Death is the death of the material part of man, and the Hades goes to the is the immaterial part of man. Now, there's going to be four ways by which 25% of the earth's population dies. First of all, by sword, death by slaughter or war; famine, death by starvation; pestilence, death by disease; and animals. Death by hunted by starving animals. Generally, even wild animals don't pursue humans, but once they become unable to catch food that they can eat, they will attack humans. So with a shortage of food, people will be hunted down by wild animals. The fifth seal switches the scene from the earth to heaven. And now he sees a vision of saints that were martyred in the first quarter of the tribulation. In the first half of the tribulation. And they cry out to God, how long will he wait before rendering judgment upon those who martyr them? And the answer they're given is to wait a bit longer because other people are yet to be martyred. Until they are, he will let the process continue. This raises two questions. First of all, who are they and how are they saved? The church is gone. The church is not presenting the gospel anymore. The church is gone. So who are they and how were they saved? And that'll be answered in Revelation 7. That'll be the first chapter we'll tackle tomorrow. The second question, who is killing them? Who is martyring them? That'll be answered in Revelation chapter 17. I think Revelation 17 follows the law of recurrence. Then we have the sixth seal in verses 12 to 16. Each of these series of judgments, the seal judgments, trumpet judgments, bowl judgments, all end up with convulsions in the heavens. And that's what you see here, convulsions of nature. There is a massive earthquake that will hit the earth. There'll be the second blackout. The Bible describes five blackouts in end times. And by blackout, we mean there'll be no light coming to the earth from the sun, moon, and stars. And the first blackout comes before the tribulation, mentioned in Joel 2, verse 31, Joel 2, 31. Here's the second blackout in connection with the sixth seal. And there are general convulsions throughout nature. And the result is there is anarchy, tremendous fear hits humanity in all classes. They run to the mountains saying, hide from us, from the wrath of God and the wrath of the Lamb. Now notice, they can explain away the first five seal judgments. They can explain the way to explain it away. But when these convulsions come on a massive earthly and heavenly sphere, they finally realize this is something that God is doing. But instead of running to God, they run away from him. But notice it mentions the wrath of God and the wrath of the Lamb. But the ones who are saying this are the unbelievers. The wrath began with the first seal. But only with the sixth seal does even unbelieving humanity begin to realize they are suffering the wrath of God. But again, they flee from him and not to him. Okay, we're going to stop here. Let me make a couple of announcements, and then I'll tell you one more rabbi story. Let me show a couple of other books. This book here, Israelology, this actually was originally my doctorate dissertation for New York University. And this deals theologically, all the Bible teaches about Israel theologically, past, present, and future. In the first chapter, I define all the terms I use so it's clear. Then chapters 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 are three different schools of replacement theology where I deal with the different schools of replacement theology. Chapters 8 and 9, I deal with dispensationalism, which is not replacement, which has been the main defender of Israel, but it lacks them a lot of the Jewish background. Then I do my own presentation in chapter 10 is Israelology. So if you don't want to read all these pages, I suggest you, if you buy this book, read the first chapter, just skip over the 10th chapter. Which I present the complete Israelology, and then you can always go back to other chapters as you will. And we're dealing mostly with Second Coming prophecies. This book is on First Coming prophecies. It's called HaMashiach, the Messiah of the Hebrew Scriptures. The two books out there which are written for the unbelieving Jewish person, one is called Jesus Was a Jew, but this is the second one. What we've done here in dealing with these Bible prophecies, like Isaiah 52, 53, we put the Hebrew on one side, English on the other. The reason we did this is because Jewish people are told by the rabbis that when you're being witnessed to by an evangelical, just simply tell them, well, the rabbi showed us that the Christians have mistranslated the Old Testament to make it sound like it's Jesus, but it's really not him. So if you hear that from somebody, you can open this and ask, well, here's Isaiah 53. Can you tell us where it's mistranslated? And most American Jews don't know any Hebrew. If they do know Hebrew, they won't be able to find the mistranslation anyway. And this might open the door to further witness. On a historical level, this is not an autobiography. It's a biography written about me from another person living in New Zealand. And she named it Chosen Fruit. And this just gives you a full biography of myself and what's happened up until a few years ago. Another book color to this, which is not in the back room, is called When Your Face Was Your Destiny. When Your Face Was Your Destiny. That's the story of my family before I came into the earth. That of the 13 branches, the Fruchtenbaum family, of which seven died in the Holocaust. And six survived, five families moved to Israel, only one family came here to America, and so on. So these are what's available back there. Pardon? Oh, I'll have this. Okay, I'll bring those books tomorrow, that'd be good. Now for your next rabbi story. There's a There's a story of an Orthodox Jewish rabbi who had a synagogue in New York City. Being Orthodox, he knew the Old Testament pretty well. He didn't know anything about the New Testament. He only had a small synagogue, so they paid him enough for him to meet all his monthly expenses, but never had any money left over. He had this great desire to visit Israel, never had the money to go. But after a while, a donation came to the synagogue. It was designated for the rabbi's trip for 1 month to Israel, and there was enough money for him to bring his wife, so he has to come with him. His wife says, "Listen, if I go to Israel with you, I'll have to bring my mother with me." Rabbi says, "This is not a good idea. Let's be honest, your mother and I just don't get along. Every time she comes over, we have one argument, usually sometimes two. We'll be in Israel for 30 days. That's 30 up to 60 arguments. This is not a good idea." His wife says, "Listen, if I go to Israel and not bring her, I'll never hear the end of it. She will fetch, she will complain, she'll drive me to early grave. To keep peace in the family, either go by yourself, that's fine with me, but if you want me to come with you, I'll have to bring her with me to keep peace in the family." Rabbi says, "Well, I don't want to go to Israel by myself, so go ahead and bring her, and I'll find a way to live with it." And so all three of them take off for Israel, and they begin with the north and finally move south. And finally, at the halfway point of the trip, they arrive in Jerusalem. And while they're in Jerusalem, his mother-in-law passes away and dies of a heart attack. They've got to figure out how to get the body to New York City. New York City has a very large Jewish cemetery, and their family owns several plots for the family. I went to the American consulate to find out what he had to do, and the consular worker told him, "Listen, Rabbi, there's so much red tape in this country, it's going to be very expensive. It's going to cost you about $30,000. But Rabbi, she's a Jewish woman, which means she can be buried right here in Jerusalem. It'll only cost you about $3,000, save a lot of money." Rabbi thought for a moment or two and says, no, whatever. No matter what the cost, I want the body sent back to New York. I'll find a way to pay for it later." And their council worker said, "You must really love your mother-in-law to put out this expense. You'll be in debt a long time." Rabbi said, "Well, to be honest, that's not quite where I'm coming from. It's just that I remember a story. I don't know why I know the story. Maybe I read it somewhere. Maybe somebody told me the story. I don't know why I know the story. But I know the story of a Jewish man who was buried here in Jerusalem. Then 3 days later, he came back to life. I can't take that chance."